Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we certainly can reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Well, hello again, and welcome back. Today's an exciting day in some parts of the country, the solar eclipse. Of course, we don't see much of it here in Arizona. So instead, I'm going to read some really fun stories about long ago and how life was a bit difficult. This one is entitled Life in the Mountains of East Tennessee. He loved the world that came with his home. This was written and sent in by Douglas Clark. In the mountains of East Tennessee during the 1950s, life changed with the seasons. In the late spring, winter clothes, including the dreaded long johns, were taken off and stored for the next winter. Most enjoyed was the removal of our big, high-top brogans we called clodhoppers. These shoes were heavy as lead and picked up a ton of mud. As soon as possible, going barefoot was the order of the day. Over the winter, our feet had become tender. There were many ways to toughen them up, but my favorites were wading in the rocky bottom creek and climbing trees. Kids going barehoof, as Dad called it, had to be careful and watch where they stepped. Stepping on a briar or thorn was painful, but most dreaded was a stone bruise or a stumped toe. But what I remember most about the mountains is not the stumped toes or winter clothes. It's the distinctive sounds and smells of the mountains, our home and our farm. The morning wake-up call came from our rooster, Big Red. I sat up in bed and took a deep breath and listened. The sizzle and smell of bacon frying filled my senses, but most enticing was the aroma of Mom's fresh baked biscuits. After breakfast, it was my lot in life to gather eggs and feed the farm animals. I paused before entering the barn and inhaled the fragrance of honeysuckle growing along the old logging road. I listened to the songbirds as they welcomed the new day. High in the sky, the wild geese were winging and honking their way back north. After bringing down hay from the barn loft, my next stop was the chicken house. When I entered, all the hens were out in the barnyard except one, Henrietta. All the others were Rhode Island Reds, but she was a Dominecker and protected her nest and eggs as if they were gold. She watched me as I gathered the eggs, and when I came near, she rose up and spread her wings. I made a detour. If anyone wanted her eggs, they could come and get them. As I stepped from the chicken house, I paused and listened. Suddenly, there sounded the long, mournful whistle of the Louisville and Nashville morning train. The shrill traveled up from the valley and echoed through the surrounding mountains. The engineer was warning anyone near Wilson's Crossing that the train was gathering speed to climb the grade at Hickory Ridge. As the blare of the train whistle faded, I felt a longing. Someday I'm going to ride on that big train all the way to Nashville, I whispered. Once a week, it was our chore to remove the weeds and rocks from my family garden. I carried my hoe and the rock bucket. Buddy Earl carried his hoe and our fruit jar of water. By early morning, the weeds were chopped down and the bucket of rocks was dumped on the rock pile. we were ready for a short rest. As we passed the barn, our older brother, Harold, was at the grinding wheel, sharpening our three axes. He looked up and pointed toward the house. "You two better get a move on. Mama's going to send one of you to the store." Being older than Buddy Earl, I knew it was going to be me. After receiving my marching orders, I hurried out the door and read the lists. Baking powder, salt, and yeast. I knew this meant Mama would be baking bread come Wednesday. Our family had a weekly schedule. Monday was wash day, Wednesday was baking day, Saturday was going to town, and Sunday was always church. Although it was only a dirt path, I decided to travel the shortcut down the mountain. As I approached the small country store, I saw a familiar sight. Two older men sitting on the bench outside were swapping stories of the mountains. I wanted to stop and listen as they told of haints that roamed the mountains and the cries of wampus cats. Most of all, I enjoyed the tales of long-abandoned log cabins and what might have happened to the folks who once lived there. Soon, I would be 13 years old and allowed to roam the mountains if I took my dog, Ranger, and Old Tom with me. Old Tom was our single-barrel shotgun. I entered the store and looked around. Nothing had changed. The old wood-burning potbelly stove still sat in the center of the store with a few straight-backed chairs around it. The Cracker Barrel still had the 2 cents each sign, and the sour pickles were still 5 cents. Behind the counter, the storekeeper, Mr. Johnson, stopped reading the newspaper and took my list. As he gathered the items, I looked over the jars of Hard Rock candy. I was tempted to have a couple of jawbreakers put on Daddy's bill, but I quickly changed my mind. After the items were placed in a brown paper bag, Mr. Johnson pulled a pencil from behind his ear. As always, he wet the end of the pencil and wrote what I had received on a small receipt pad. He tore out the yellow copy and handed it to me. After thanking Mr. Johnson and saying goodbye, I was out the door and headed for home. As I passed Mr. Jim and his best friend, I caught the term wampus cat. I lingered just long enough to hear how he had been chased down Black Gum Hollow and escaped by jumping into Little River. Someday I would get that old cat and be a hero. After returning home and giving Mom the baking goods, I walked outside. I took a deep breath and marveled at how the mountain seemed to go on forever. This was Life in the Mountains of East Tennessee by Douglas Clark. This next story is entitled, Our Door Was Always Open. Whether someone lost a cow or their job, they were always welcome here. This story was sent in by Marie Latta. I once thought my folks invented the open door policy. Our door was always open. Whether it was a neighbor searching for his cow who had escaped through a low spot in the line fence, a student selling magazine subscriptions, or a Watkins salesman, all were invited to sit down, have a glass of iced tea or a cup of coffee, and visit a while. We lived on a farm in Michigan and welcomed everyone, even overnighters. I was 8 years old and seldom had playmates. The nearest neighbor was a quarter of a mile away, and the only girl my age lived half a mile in the other direction. Like my folks, I loved company. Mom's friend, Olive, often came for the weekend. Aunt Dot and Uncle Bus, newly married, stayed a few weeks until they saved enough money to rent a place. The longest any visitors stayed was in 1940, when Uncle Floyd and Aunt Ellen and their four children came. We saw their car drive up while we were eating supper, and Mom opened the door to greet them. "Come in, sit down," she said as she dished up more food. "Marie, go down to the cellar and get a quart of peaches and one of green beans," she told me. Thanks to gardening and home canning, we always had a good supply of canned foods. Dad began putting more chairs at the table and placed two more at the kitchen cabinet. "So, what brings you folks way out here?" he asked. My uncle and aunt lived 24 miles away in Battle Creek. Uncle Floyd didn't answer, but his wife spoke up. "Floyd lost his job," she said. "We got evicted because we're behind on the rent, and we haven't any place to stay." Mom and Dad did not hesitate. "We'll put you up," they both said. Taking in a family of six wasn't easy. We had only three small bedrooms, so I shared my bed with my cousins, Ruth and Darla. My uncle and aunt took the other upstairs bedroom. The downstairs bedroom was my parents', so the boys, Frank and Richard, slept in the living room, taking turns on the davenport. The unlucky one got a blanket and pillow on the floor. The next few weeks, Uncle Floyd looked for work. But when he was home, he helped Dad with lawn mowing and weeding the garden. Aunt Ellen gave Mom a hand with household chores, and as they worked, they chatted and caught up on family doings. I loved having everyone there. We kids played hide-and-seek, jumped rope, climbed trees, and played croquet. I'd longed for playmates. Now, with four cousins, the time flew by. But it wasn't all fun and games. We had no indoor plumbing, so there was usually a waiting line at the outdoor toilet. And laundry increased dramatically. With our old wringer washer, it took all day Monday to get everything washed and dried on the outdoor clotheslines. On Tuesdays, Mom and Aunt Ellen took turns ironing. Initially, cooking went smoothly, but Mom had her way of doing things, and so did Aunt Ellen. They decided Mom would cook one day and Aunt Ellen the next. Both were good cooks, so that satisfied everyone. Pumping pails of water and carrying them inside, washing dishes, feeding chickens, and gathering eggs were chores assigned to us kids. We grumbled about the dishes especially, but we hurried to finish so we could play. Much as I liked my cousins, I was dismayed when Ruth dropped my music box and it never played again. Darla broke the collar tabs off my paper doll's clothes. When we played catch, Frank threw the ball close to the house and broke a kitchen window. After 2 months, Uncle Floyd found a job and began looking for a house to rent. When another month rolled by, the family retrieved their furniture from storage in a friend's garage and were packing up to move back to the city. We waved goodbye with mixed feelings. On the plus side, there would be no more waiting for the toilet, no huge piles of dishes to wash, no having to listen to Uncle Floyd's radio station every night. But their visit reminded us how blessed we were. We had a home, food, and enough money to pay the bills. My parents were happy to share with Uncle Floyd's family in their time of need. Dad enjoyed reminiscing with his brother. Mom liked catching up on family gossip and adding some of Aunt Ellen's casseroles to her recipe file. And I loved playing with my cousins. And I had had one of the most fun summers ever. And this was Our Door Was Always Open by Marie Latta. And here's another story of people helping people. It's entitled Baby Blue Prom Dress. She didn't know her neighbor had not forgotten a long ago favor. This was written by Diana Vickery. In the 1960s, in my hometown of Aurora, Illinois, it was not uncommon for high school girls to have dresses custom made for special occasions like prom and homecoming. In some cases, the cost could be less than an off-the-rack dress that needed alterations. Many extremely talented women worked at home creating and altering clothing. To call them mere seamstresses seems an underestimation of their skills. Three houses away from ours was such a woman. Her name was Emma. The first dress Emma made for me was for homecoming at Marmion Military Academy, a local boys' school, my senior year. The dress was a periwinkle blue, lightweight wool sheath dress, fully lined and very grown up. I loved it. But when my grandfather died 2 days before homecoming, I was in no mood for dancing, and my parents deemed it inappropriate for me to go to the event. The dress always reminded me of that sad time, and I had neither the heart nor another occasion to wear it. I don't even remember what happened to it. For senior prom, I asked Emma to make a formal ankle-length gown. I bought the fabric and chose the pattern. It was suitably modest, so the nuns at Madonna High School would be happy. The dress was made of silk-like peau de soie in baby blue with a matte finish. Over the dress, I wore a second dress made of very sheer shadow lace in a matching shade of blue. After several fittings, the dress was ready, and I walked to Emma's house to pick it up and pay her. I had saved enough from my after-school waitress job at a drugstore lunch counter, 75 cents an hour, to pay for it myself. But Emma would not take a penny. "Your father did a great favor for my husband," was all she said. I was puzzled. What kind of favor could Dad have done for Oscar that would warrant Emma not taking money for all of her wonderful work? Dad was puzzled, too. After scouring his memory, Dad remembered one occasion when he was walking by their house on his way to the hardware store and saw Oscar sitting on the porch. The two got to talking, and Dad asked, "Are you waiting for someone?" Oscar answered that yes, he was waiting for a friend to take him to the lumberyard, but it looked as if he was not coming. Emma and Oscar, post-World War II immigrants to the United States, did not own a car. "Well, when I get back from the store, if your friend hasn't arrived, I'll take you to the lumberyard," said Dad. My father always had a soft spot in his heart for immigrants like Emma and Oscar, as his own parents had been immigrants just before World War I. When Dad walked by on his return trip, Oscar was still waiting, so Dad drove him to the lumberyard. Dad didn't think a trip to the lumberyard was that big a favor, but apparently Emma did, and I benefited from it. My baby blue dress was perfect, and I felt like a princess wearing it. After prom was over, I asked Emma to alter the dress's hem to knee length so I could wear it under my graduation robe. The dress plays a prominent role in the photo album I kept and still have. Looking at those photos always makes me smile and think of our neighbor, Emma, and how even tiny favors can have oversized meaning to the recipients. And this story was entitled Baby Blue Prom Dress. Now the story, it's entitled Something Special for All Three. Sisters passed down their first communion dress through the years. This was written and sent in by Charlotte Sneeden. I grew up in a small southern Minnesota town back in the mid-1960s and 70s. My dad worked a full-time job in addition to working on the small hobby farm where we lived. With four children, my family did many things to help us get by. The first thing that comes to mind is the hand-me-down clothes. Being the youngest of the four children, I often received hand-me-downs from my older cousins and my siblings, some of which were even from my brother. Actually, my favorite item was from my big brother, a pair of gray jeans with an embroidered pirate on the leg. It's funny to look back at the family pictures where I'm wearing the same clothes that my siblings had worn a few years earlier. On occasion, my godparents, my aunt and uncle, would stop by the farm for a visit and would often bring a box full of clothes from my older cousins. It was fun to dig through the items to find ones that I liked and that fit. But there was one particular hand-me-down from my sisters that we still have today. It was the most special outfit, and I couldn't wait for my turn to wear it. It was a frilly, bright white First Communion dress and veil. It was first worn by my big sister Michelle in 1967. She's a few years older than me, so I don't remember her wearing it, but I marveled at the pictures of her I saw in the family photo album. She looked like a little angel. As I grew up, I saw that special dress stored away in the closet, just waiting for the next sister to have her first communion. In 1970, my second oldest sister, Angela, had her turn to wear it. She was much taller than Michelle, so my mother set her creativity into action and sewed an extra layer of material to the bottom. It was perfect. Michelle looked like an angel, too, and I was green with envy. Finally, in the spring of 1973, it was my turn to wear that special dress on my special First Communion Day. My mother had to go back to her sewing skills in order to alter the dress once again for me. It didn't matter to me that I wasn't able to get a pretty new dress and a fancy new veil like all my friends were talking about. My dress was special, not only because it represented this important occasion, but because it had been worn by my big sisters, whom I looked up to so much. Being able to wear this special dress meant the world to me, and I was so proud. In addition to this being a very wonderful memory, it has also become a family tradition. My sister Angela has five daughters, and she carried on this tradition by having each of her daughters wear their one special dress for their First Communion Day. This was Something Special for All Three by Charlotte Sneeden. Here's an item also about clothing. It's entitled More Than Just Clothes by Janet Govan. Do you ever wonder what happened to the sun-bleached and air-dried sheets of yesteryear? Do you remember how good it felt to get into a bed when you were a child and smell the sheets? I believe it was the pure cotton fabric that was so prevalent back when I was a child in the early 1950s. Someone has called it the fabric of our lives. Most of our clothes were made from cotton. My mom would wash them and then hang the clothes on the line in the bright sunshine of those hot summer days while we kids played in the backyard with our neighborhood friends and homemade toys. For Easter one year, my mom bought matching gingham dresses for my sister and me. One was blue checked and one pink checked. They both had a white apron sewn onto the front and a full skirt. We also got straw bonnets with big bows that hung down the back. Our shoes were black patent leather ankle-strapped flats. My mother loved ankle straps. You don't see them so much anymore. Looking back, I loved them too. Oh, how good it felt to be dressed up then. We would stand in front of the vanity with the triple mirrors in my mother's bedroom, where we could see our whole reflection from head to toe. Now that I'm grown, I realize that it wasn't just the clothes that made us feel so good. Our mom was also instilling in her children that we should feel good from the inside out. Our reflections told us that we looked good on the outside, but she didn't want to dress us up just to look good. She wanted to raise us up to be good. Somehow, they wore so well together back then. And this is More Than Just Clothes by Janet Govan. Well, that looks like we're out of time, and so we'll close the program. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.